I'm delighted to welcome you all to the Festival of Politics here in the unique venue of the Scottish Parliament. I'm very pleased to be joined on the panel today by three esteemed speakers. Firstly, Paolo Garbaudo. I hope I've pronounced that well. He's a lecturer of digital culture and society at King's College London. Apart from his previous academic posts at Middlesex University and the American University in Cairo, Paolo has acted as a journalist covering social media movements, political affairs and the environmental issues. He has also worked as a new media artist exhibiting art festivals and shows. We're also joined by Victoria Bowman, who heads up the research team at the Young Foundation's diverse range of projects. The foundation aims to tackle major social changes by working alongside communities using the tools of research and social innovation, and Victoria previously worked for Ofgem and Nesta. And I'm also delighted to be joined by a colleague of mine in the Scottish Parliament, and that is the MSP for Edinburgh North and Leith and the Minister for Europe, Migration and International Development. Ben is a regular user of social media in his role as a politician, but also as a human, I suppose, these days as well. And prior to becoming an MSP, Ben was a solicitor and had additional roles in the private, public and third sectors. Can we please give all our panel a very warm welcome? Now, there will be an opportunity for members of the audience to put questions and views to the panel throughout the event. However, I want to start by opening the discussion by giving each panel member a couple of minutes. And I've been told by the organisers that I have to ask them eight questions they need to answer in 2 minutes. So we can see how impressive they do that. So in 2 minutes, tell us about your own social media use, any perceived pros and cons of social media in politics in the last decade, any examples of when social media may have backfired on you personally. How do your political parties control or edit politicians using social media? How we can control the political trolls? That's a two-minute conversation in itself. Would you agree that that permits direct contact with voters? How does it help your political campaigns? How does it help reach the message? And do you think that today's social media has impacted on our political lives? And with that, I'll hand over to Paolo.
All of that together.
Allegedly, you have to answer all that in 2 minutes, but I don't think you'll be able to.
All right. I mean, first and foremost, I guess, as many people use social media for different purposes. I mean, for purposes of research, for personal reasons, family reasons. Your sister is a baby, you say, very good, a beautiful baby, birthdays, friends, right? I mean, stuff we all do. I mean, there is all this aspect of kind of personal care, personal engagement, celebration, sorrow sometimes. There's the political element. I mean, as many other people, I'm kind of politically active on social media, express my opinion, I campaign for things, I campaign for causes. And I guess the main element there is really the conflation between all these different spheres. That is, a generation ago, you would have done these things in three different ways. You would have cared about your family in a very intimate way. The only medium you perhaps would have used would be the telephone or letters, personal letters, that would be apart from the public sphere, the public domain. Nobody would know what you were doing in your family life or your personal life, and perhaps for very good reasons. Right? And by the same token, you would do your politics in a public sphere that was also separate from your family, your personal sphere. Right, where you would read about politics, you would express your opinions, right, and do those other things in a sphere apart from that. And in turn, your work sphere would be separate. Right, your boss was not supposed to know your political opinions, right, and it was not supposed to know what you were doing in your family or your personal life. Right, so I guess to a great extent, that is the problem, that is the issue. Right, that when all these spheres conflate, then there are conflicts of interest between these spheres. Namely, people perhaps don't express their political views because they're afraid of what their boss may think of those views or their family, right? Or they don't engage sufficiently with their friends and family because they fear repercussions at other levels. Right? So this is, I think, one of the main issues we find that is also perhaps at the root of some of the problems we find more specifically in politics. Right? That is a certain viscerality in conversations is precisely the product of this weird intertwining between the extremely personal, the visceral, the most intimate, and the public.
But Paul, can I ask you just a quick question? You've obviously researched social media in different parts of the world. Mm. Have you done a comparison of how you think it impacts in different parts of the world, so how it may impact? For example, you did work in Cairo. Mm. You've looked at what's happened there. You've obviously got a previous experience, obviously, from Italy, and your experiences of UK politics. Do you see a difference in terms of perhaps it embraced earlier in Cairo when you had the spring uprising of young people in particular and the more recent events that have happened in the US or the UK? Do you see a difference in different parts of the world?
Completely. I mean, you see local cultures, local attitudes, local customs reflected on social media. So I was analyzing the 2014 elections in Brazil, and you could see Brazilian culture, how much it was imbuing the language of the elections, how much football torcida, the hooliganism, the slogans used there were infused in the type of language that was used, also in very nice ways. Mm. Well, I remember how boring and dull was the 2015 elections in Britain. Now I think the 2017 elections were much better. But in a way, it was speaking to a certain stereotypical imaginary of British politics as being very kind of calm, perhaps too calm, right? With all these policy memes, while in Brazil it was all about identity. It was all about emotions. It was all about you identify with Dilma Rousseff because she's a woman of the people, and you hate Aécio Neves because he's filthy entrepreneurs, allied with cartels, with narcos, whatever, right? And you could see that in Egypt as well, how, you know, right, how it has become a space where new languages have been created, tapping into old traditions, tapping into national popular culture. I mean, all our rememberings of movies we saw when we were children, or TV series, or whatever, all the things that are part of our education, or our biography. Mm. And they are remixed and refashioned in very powerful ways, in memes, in posts that are often really trying to mobilize this jargon mm-hmm. that is part of our collective life experience. Right? Mm. So it's more of a canvas where different cultures are expressed. Yes. But a canvas that obviously goes with certain rules. You cannot write more than 140 characters on Twitter, regardless of whether you are in India, in Egypt, or in the US. Now you can write more than that, but say there are boundaries to what, there are rules to what works and what doesn't work.
Yep. Right? I'm going to come back to you on the rules, because I think that's an interesting element of the discussion. Victoria.
Okay, so to answer, I think, what was your first question? How do I use social media myself? Like many people, I think I signed up to Facebook and whatever its predecessor was that I can no longer remember.
Bebo.
Sorry?
MySpace.
Friends Reunited or something. Anyway, back in the day. But actually, what I've increasingly found is that I've pulled away. I'm one of those people who has left Facebook and left Facebook before the whole kind of Cambridge Analytica that kind of confirmed my decision. For me, because like a lot of people, I think I started to find that that kind of filtered reality of Facebook was not particularly good for my mental health, seeing these kind of perfected images of all these people who I went to school with 20 years ago and hadn't spoken to since. Did I really need to see this every day? Probably not. How much time was being sucked into this kind of mindless scrolling? And so I actually just chose to step away. Now I use Twitter, but mainly professionally. I use LinkedIn, things like that, but it's mainly a professional tool for me these days. And I think you said, when has it backfired? For me personally, I discovered that the power of social media, I used to use Twitter for work at events like this, and I used to use it a lot to shout at train companies and Virgin Media, my broadband isn't working again. And then one day I went to an event and we had a comedian who was the kind of evening stand-up event at this conference. And what he'd done was he'd taken everybody who was an attendee, looked at all our Twitter accounts, and then taken the most amusing and turned them into an extended song. And unfortunately, that was me. And once you've sat in front of 800 people and had an entire song sung about your Virgin Media account ranting, and then had to see all those people the next day, you kind of realized the power of social media and started to use it quite differently. None of that's got anything to do with politics, though. So I think what I see as well, I agree with everything Paddy said, is a kind of a generational issue as well, where I look particularly at young people now and how they're using social media and actually how I can see some really good things. You see young people now who are very engaged. They're online. They understand issues that perhaps, for me, growing up in rural Somerset, never crossed my mind back in the sort of the 80s and the early 90s, whereas now those things are top of mind because they have that exposure to so many issues. But also, they're getting it in a very 140-character, quite polarising way, and it's quite hard for them to navigate and make decisions, let alone, you know, the rest of us. So I think that's a really interesting kind of direction of travel to watch going forwards, how it shapes that next generation.
Obviously, you work with young people through the Youth Foundation, and you mentioned mental health. Myself and Ben probably as well can reflect on when we're probably in a very happy, chilled mood with our family and children. We see something on social media and our mood changes. I know from my own experience of sitting in a cinema, for example, not interested in what's happening in the film or my kids, but reading endless abuse on my social media feed and recognising actually this is not normal. This is not normal for me or my kids or indeed my own mental health. And you see the mental health issues that we have across the country. How much of a contributing factor do you think social media feeds and access to these social media feeds for young people is on mental health and on mental health services?
I mean, I think it's undeniable that it's a factor, but I think it can also be a source for good. And as you know, digital media, and not just kind of traditional social media, it allows young people to connect to each other, to connect to sources of support. They will seek support for those very same issues online as much as they will experience some kind of negativity from it sometimes. So I think it's just an integral part of the way they live their lives. I think perhaps what's more challenging is how much it kind of reduces the interaction in the real world, that you will go and you'll see a group of young people sitting around kind of probably all texting each other in the same room rather than talking, and that kind of natural conversation, that natural bumping into each other, and I think that applies to everybody. You can have some very polarised discussions, things become very binary on social media. You can talk to lots of people and that's great, but you would have a very different conversation if you were in a room or if you were at a party, if you were, you know, in the park talking to your neighbours, and you would see a much more nuanced view of people, not just their politics or not just their kind of position on a certain issue. Yep. And it's how you kind of manage to get the best of both worlds.
Thank you. Ben.
Thank you. First of all, welcome all of you to your parliament. It's great to see you here this morning. The invitation to be part of this discussion this morning came quite unexpectedly to me because there are so many of my colleagues here in the Scottish Parliament who use social media so well. And I was thinking, well, maybe what is it that I do slightly differently that I can bring to this discussion? And what I would emphasise is that whether before becoming a candidate and then a politician and thereafter, for me, the biggest question of social media is how you use it. Do you use it to put forward positive and constructive messages, or do you use it to put forward negative and destructive messages? And I think our discussion today will go into that place. Mm. But in terms of what I've tried to do since being a candidate and an elected representative is use social media to connect, first of all, with my constituents. And that has been reasonably successful in terms of constituents knowing what I'm doing, finding out more about what's happening in my constituency as a result of what I'm putting out there, finding out about what other organisations in the constituency do or are engaged in, and also how to get in touch with me and reach me if they have an idea that they'd like to suggest to me or require some assistance. And that's mostly been through Facebook and Twitter. And over the recent year, I've tried to show a bit more of who I am beyond a politician through Instagram, which is a really softer way of connecting. Today's discussion could go in so many different directions, but from a personal level, in terms of the way I use social media, I find it most useful for, one, finding out bits of information that I would have not come across before social media was upon us, whether it's accessing the mainstream media in a more fruitful and comprehensive way, or finding out new sources of information and being able to follow and find individuals who you wouldn't necessarily have connected with before. And What I also find it most useful for, as I said beforehand, was how it was connection since being in this position. How do we connect more with each other, but without losing that face-to-face contact? And I think that's the biggest question. Just finally, I would say, and I hope our discussion does go somewhere on this today, is that the biggest challenge we face is that where the balance of social media is towards dealing with the really big challenges that we face politically, socially and economically, or narrows our focus and our consideration. And that is a constant challenge and question for us all, whether we're politicians or voters or young people or old people.
Just on that, Ben, you get a sense now from media, from wider global politics, from social media, that division is a bit more fashionable, and compromise is seen as being a dirty word, and prejudice and hate seems to be on the rise again. How much do you think that is to do with social media, or how much of it is, you think, other associated issues that would have happened anyway, but social media has perhaps just amplified it in a different way?
Yeah, I think, to me, words are important. So whenever, maybe that's because I've got a degree in philosophy and a degree in law, so I'm a bit of a wordsmith, and sometimes obsessively so. But I use social media carefully. And that's because you need to think about how people are going to interpret it. And there was a phrase I heard when just before I became a candidate, actually, and it was, loose tweets can sink fleets. And I think it's quite a good term to summarise the point that, you know, one off-the-cuff tweet while you're rushing for a bus can really damage your own reputation and the ideas for which you're associated with. And you have to be really careful of that, and also the hurt that can cause. So responsible use of language generally is important to me, and that is and should be important on social media. And you know, we face some really big challenges as generations across the world, and we need all mediums to be utilised to collaborate on how we deal with those challenges, not to create conflict for the sake of dramatisation or self-promotion. And I think that's a question for the media generally and politics generally, not just in social media. Yep. We should be looking to engage as meaningfully as possible, not just looking for the next headline or putting a tweet out there because we know it's going to resonate with our base and get us another 25 followers and 100 retweets.
Yep. So I think that's something we'll pick up on with all three panellists. Often I'm asked by young aspiring politicians about what advice would you give in social media? And the answer I always give back is, imagine your tweet was on the front page of a newspaper. How would it make you feel? How would it make you look? Imagine it was on the front page of the Sunday Herald or the Sun or anything else. And think about what you write before you put it up. But I think we've had obviously a lot of negative issues raised about social media so far in terms of the panel discussion. So I want to switch to the positive part of it just for a second. Is what opportunities do you think we have through the age of social media in terms of politics, whether that be greater access to support services, learning more from each other, whether it be sharing each other's experiences? If you look at, for example, the Me Too campaign, if you look at the campaign around everyday biases, whether it be around racism, whether it be around anti-Semitism, whether it be around Islamophobia, whether it be around LGBT issues, being able to find and empower people along social media to build a campaign to try and affect change. Surely there are also hopes and opportunities that come from social media. You want to just say a bit about that, Paolo, from your own perspective?
Before talking again about the negatives.
We'll focus on the positives for a bit. I think it's important.
As in the discussion we had before, I'm quite optimistic actually about social media influence on politics, in the sense that I'm quite allergic to a certain pessimism that has become prevalent, especially among liberals and progressives, in the aftermath of the 2016 US elections. So where there is all this sense, you know, that social media is responsible for all the ills of politics and stuff. I mean, there are many positives to social media and politics. First and foremost, social media have facilitated the involvement of millions of people who were not interested in politics before, once again in politics. You see that everywhere. I mean, I, as an Italian, I see it everywhere. I see it in political groups. I see it among my friends on Facebook, acquaintances that I would have never thought they would be interested in politics and now are commenting on politics. Sometimes they do that with a language that is not appropriate. Sometimes they do it with a lot of spelling mistakes, and they are ridiculed for that by many people. Look at this mass of ignorant people who is coming to Facebook, and they pretend they can speak about politics, and they don't know how to place the right accent in Italian words. Or in Italy, the joke goes that instead of using the exclamation mark, since it is on the same button as the number one, they often, in the rush, just type one. So when people try to imitate them, they do one, exclamation mark, also because they are known to use a lot of exclamation marks. These are the so-called cyber plebs, right? That is, the new people who have come back to social media in recent years. And I think I'm for the plebs in general, so I'm for low-income people, for the lower classes. And therefore, for me, in general terms, is only a positive news that working class people, poor people, are coming to political conversations. Then obviously, it is a matter of how these people are guided and educated through political education and discussions, and how they are involved in politics in a positive manner. But I think one mistake that has been done a lot by liberals and progressives is to put these people in the basket of deplorables, right? As the famous saying by Hillary Clinton went, which automatically alienates these people, tells people who may have fancy theories, may perhaps subscribe to some conspiracy theories, whatever, instead of engaging with them and saying, look, what you're saying is wrong for this reason, and this reason, here is the evidence, just saying you're stupid, you're ignorant, you don't belong. And perhaps mass franchise should be abolished. I mean, now there are groups on Facebook. Yesterday I was looking at one. Let's abolish franchise, free franchise for everybody. I mean, there is a war in turn, because indeed there's a lot of potential in the fact that people are coming back to political discussions and that they are using the written medium. Right? So we come from decades where people were sitting on a couch. And I've been brought up in Berlusconi's Italy in the 90s, and I've seen that, and it was just images where they couldn't react, they couldn't express even the reaction, not their action, not even their reaction. Now, at the very least, people can express a reaction. Yeah? Perhaps it is a small progress, but still it is some form of progress, what we had before.
Just on that, Paolo, because I think part of, and Ben touched upon this around political ideology and political norms isn't part of the challenge that if people give angry reactions on social media, so if you disagree with Donald Trump's election, you're shouting out, how could people be so stupid to vote for Donald Trump? If you're a Donald Trump supporter, how could people be so stupid not to vote for Donald Trump? Yeah. If you're a Brexit supporter, how could you be so stupid to vote for Brexit? How could you be so stupid not to vote for Brexit? If it's an independence question, how could you be stupid to vote yes? Or someone say, how could you be stupid to vote no? Is that part of actually trying to understand why people have voted a certain way, why people feel a certain way, and the need for politicians to try and understand why people vote in a certain way in order to address concerns they have in our life is probably a much more important way to go down rather than creating an us versus them and that angry response on social media?
Completely. I mean, I think that what the anger that we are undoubtedly see on social media is a reflection of what happens outside social media, of profound socioeconomic causes that should be known to everybody with some kind of understanding of contemporary political and economic reality, is year 10 of a recession that is not really ending, and there's no end in sight, there's no solution to the economic crisis. I'm afraid, looking at Italian events, that perhaps we are heading towards even greater problems in economic terms, even greater instability. I don't think that the sky is clearing anytime soon. But it's not clear for a very simple reason, because there's no plan, right? I mean, there are different plans, different competing plans. There is a trade war going on between China and the US right? There is no stability on your eyes, right? So what that means is that hardship is going to continue for some time. I mean, nobody should wish that that happens, but that is the reality. So what that means is that then that is reflected on social media, where growing social inequality is reflected in growing political polarization. You should just expect that it is, in a way, is nothing new. Perhaps social media amplifies that. Yeah. Definitely some anger that is there is out of place, but ultimately politics has always required a thick skin, right? And it's a hard truth that perhaps is coming back after some years where we had some false impression of social peace.
But Troy, just focusing on the positives for a second around, you know, your role with the Youth Foundation, the power of building campaigns through social media to influence politics, to influence politicians. You want to just say a bit about the campaigning potential of social media if it's used the right way?
I mean, I think there are a lot of positives to social media in the political sphere. At the very simplest level, it enables you so much better to actually engage with your local politician. You no longer have to go and stand on a Thursday morning between 10 and 2 outside their constituency office and hope you get to the front of the queue. If you want to engage with them, you've got a direct channel of communication. But it is a very, very short form of communication. And so I think, for me, the big question is, how do you take this kind of increased political engagement, and incipient as it might be, this kind of reaction to what's happening in the world, and translate it into a kind of a more engaged form of politics and democracy? How do we use it to increase voter turnout? How do we use it to help people to understand the nuances of an issue? Because I think when you start to look at kind of social media campaigning and social media interactions, they are very necessarily reduced to that kind of that headline and little more than that headline than you would get on The Sun. So it's very difficult to do that thing of saying, well, okay, you... whatever, lock Hillary Clinton up. Well, actually, you're wrong for this reason, this reason, this reason, and this reason. It's very difficult to effectively do that on social media. It can be a very nuanced, very complicated argument, and people can walk away. They'll just stop reading because the kind of the emotional intensity often of those interactions. But how do you take it so that those people who obviously care about the issues and obviously want to make a change in their communities and in their society, how do we use it to kind of lever that and get them more involved in politics in a more meaningful way? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, tweeting or engaging with the debate only goes so far. You only really change things if you go out and vote and you go out and you really understand the issues. So I think that's kind of the next step. How do we use technology to do that? And people are trying, people are experimenting, but at the moment they are probably still where social media was a while back, and it's kind of stuck in those elite kind of spaces.
Yeah. Ben, just a question. Obviously, you're a SNP government minister, and people would, I think, recognise and accept that the first mainstream political party in the UK that probably properly understood social media as a campaigning tool was probably the Scottish National Party, in terms of the success it had in 2007, 2011, then the use of it through the independence referendum. Do you want to just say a bit about the use of social media around political campaigning and building movements around their individual issues or wider social movement?
Yeah, I would also like to talk about it being a power for good as well, because within that context, when we started off on this question about the positive element of social media, I said in the last answer about the power of words, but actually for me, when social media can be at its most powerful in a positive way, is utilising video and sound through social media platforms. And actually, as soon as you asked that question, the thing that appeared in my mind was this passage, out of many we are one, while we breathe we hope, and when we are met with cynicism and doubt we will respond with that timeless creed that sums up the spirit of a nation, yes we can. Yeah. And everyone recognises that, because in 2008, when Obama was campaigning, those words from that speech resonated across the world through a video of him making that speech throughout that campaign. And to me, that's where it can social media can tilt from something that can be quite negative in the human condition and negative to our politics to be something hugely empowering and hugely positive in terms of galvanising positive change. Mm-hmm. And even social change, you think of the number of people that are now putting out videos on a daily basis to try and help people think beyond their own issues around sense of failure or a sense of feeling down. There's a whole movement, with the TED movement, in terms of TED Talks, about trying to get new ideas out there. So while words and sentiments through social media can cause a lot of negative damage, for me, utilising sound and video can make a really positive change. And certainly, I think that's where political campaigns, whether it's the SNP or others before and thereafter, that's where it's really had a positive effect by connecting people through video and sound
to
believe in things can be better.
And infrastructure-wise, because I mean it as a positive, I think people would accept that the SNP used it in a really hopeful way in 2009 and 2007, 2011. Is infrastructure-wise, because there'll be people that represent organisations here, people that represent the third sector organisations, maybe businesses, maybe aspiring politicians in the room, is infrastructure-wise, what needs to go in behind that to make it work and to have that amplification?
Sure, I mean, I think there are people who make videos on a very professional basis, and they're beautiful, the films that they put together, but actually, from my own perspective in terms of engaging with my constituents, just a quick vlog, as they call it, in the rain after a community event or raising awareness of a local issue have been some of the most successful bits of social media that I've done. And I think authenticity through visuals and through video and sound is where social media can be at its most powerful for good.
Now, Paula used a very interesting word, which was rules. And you mentioned rules around the number of characters that are on perhaps the age profile, though people probably break the rules in terms of some of the age profiles. People also perhaps view social media as uncontrolled in terms of what people can say, what people can amplify, what people can share. Do you think it requires more rules? Do you think there should be more rules put on social media platforms, whether that be Facebook, whether that be Twitter, whether that be other forms of social media?
I mean, definitely you need rules and you need to stop crime, but I think that there are many already laws in place to act against crime committed online, namely libel, defamation, hate speech. You can simply use existing laws to punish behaviors that go against the law online, right? I mean, there's now a lot of a bit of a panic from some politicians and many of to create web-specific laws. But I think that is actually a wrong path, since perhaps you may amend existing laws to make them applicable to online behavior, but ultimately it's not that the online world is a virtual bubble somewhere detached from reality. It has so strong effects on our reality precisely because it is part of reality. Mm. Therefore, the best path there is to ensure that laws are applied online against whatever threats, harassment, stalking. Mm. I mean, there's so many bad things that can be done online. Obviously, there is also an element that has to do with the business model of these companies, namely Facebook is so profitable, or say it is so valuable, at least in the stock exchange, more than profitable, because it uses a business model where it has very minimal staff. If it were to moderate significantly the content that people post, it would require far larger staff, right? Which perhaps wouldn't make it viable as companies. Yep. The same applies to all these social media companies. They basically say, as Pontius Pilatus, can we wash our hands, you know, all the content that is here? That is, for a number of reasons, legal reasons, they want to be legally responsible for the content they host, economic, right? And then they also present in a way ideologically, in a sense, we are a kind of neutral space where everybody, regardless of persuasion, can express themselves, right? So I think that there's been an emancipatory element to this, in the fact that indeed people who couldn't express themselves before now have expressed themselves. There's been a bit of a reshuffling of the cards, say, in the political games, as it were, allowing for certain power balances to perhaps rebalance in ways that were more in line with actual what was happening in society. Obviously, you need to have rules to keep pace with that. Mm. You also need to have conventions among people, like social conventions, in place to regulate this. So where people are learning not to get too heated when they are engaging in a social media debate, there are points, you know, where you perhaps need to kind of calm down, and in turn, people advising one another. I mean, these are customs, right? Social customs that emerge in any era. But, and they are still in the process of establishing themselves in, the, in this context.
But just on social conventions, that if you were in a room, so this room today, you would moderate yourself, or there'd be an element of moderation by other people in the room about what you might say. Surely social media takes that away, so people will say things that they would never dream of saying to someone's face, but they think it's okay to say it on social media?
Yes, I mean, it's something we were already saying a bit before, in the sense that society is kept together by hypocrisy. Right. I mean, we can survive as a community because we don't tell each other what we think of one another. Right. Otherwise, families would collapse, groups would collapse, communities, you know? And social media eliminates that by creating a disinhibition where people feel entitled to say anything to people which then they meet in their everyday life. Right. So I bump into several cases of kind of brothers and sisters unfriending each other on Facebook because, yeah, one voted yes or no in the Scottish independence referendum, or in Brazil in elections, in the election campaign. Right? You find these families in a way torn. Perhaps, I mean, it's too dramatic to say family torn apart, but say that there are real conflicts that are happening within among friends, among families, on political issues, which again has to do with the conflation I was talking about at the very start. The question is, I mean, perhaps politics is coming back simply, right? For a long time, society was depoliticized. People didn't care that much about politics. Now politics is coming back big time because of big inequality, because of polarization. And we need to find ways to deal once again with that, right? Mm. And to kind of keep it under control, right?
But Paul, you raised something for a second there. I'm going to do a test in the room. Who here uses social media? Put your hand up if you use social media. So a clear majority in the room use social media. Yeah. So I've had loads of people anecdotally tell me they've fallen out with a family member or a friend on a political issue, whether that be around Brexit, whether that be around independence referendum, whether it be a family member sharing a Britain First post, for example. Put your hand up if you've ever fallen out with a family or friend because of something that's been posted on social media. If your family or friends are with you in the room, then you can, then we'll find another way of doing that survey. But I saw two or three hands. Do you want to put your hand up again? Okay, so the ones that put your hand up, please remember that, because I'm going to come back to you.
Do you contemporary spat or for life?
No, a temporary spat included. A temporary spat included. Okay, more hands have gone up. Clearly, people are in with their families today. So I'm going to come back to some of you later on and have a chat about some of that. You don't need to tell us the intimacy of that, but if you want to share some of it, we'll get into some of the detail. But Drake, a question for you. How much responsibility do you think the platform has about what's put on or said on their platform? And if you think there is a responsibility, should there be added regulations or rules on those that own the platforms or control the platforms?
Yeah, I mean, I think pragmatically, it's very difficult to go down that road when you've got millions and millions of pieces of content being shared kind of hourly. Hmm. I think, you know, AI and all those things aside, pragmatically, what we can expect them to do and to police, and who kind of decides what's within that spectrum of acceptable, and as part of, we have the laws for things like hate speech for some of those behaviours. So I think, yes, we should be pushing them to monitor more closely, to take down content faster when it's flagged as offensive or obscene or whatever it might be. But I think maybe, at least in terms of politics, perhaps we should be looking at the the people who are posting the content, particularly in terms of political parties. In this country, we don't have a requirement for political advertising to actually be disclosed, that it's from any given party and that it's being funded by any given campaign. So what you've seen more recently with a lot of that kind of analysis of the Brexit advertising is that, you know, we know that Vote Leave spent 98% of their campaigning budget on digital campaigning. Mm. And it's hugely effective, and that's actually a positive. You can reach many, many people in a way that you never could before through social media. And unlike traditional campaigning methods, those who want to, you can provide the opportunity to click through instantly and find more information. You can provide people with tools to actually answer a very detailed survey about all your views and figure out factually where you sit on a political spectrum. But if you have adverts or kind of Facebook kind of promotions or those kinds of things going out, which are sometimes actually factually incorrect, through to borderline kind of deliberately incentivizing division and discord, and actually they're being funded by political organizations, and we don't even require them to put a stamp on it saying this was funded by this party. Mm. Actually, we could probably go quite a long way by actually regulating the content and the way in which political campaigning messages are allowed to be disseminated, and actually, you know, having a system of fact-checking before they're allowed to go live, and having, you know, that more transparency about the process. And I think actually that's probably where it's easier.
No, I think that's a very important point. I mean, the Advertising Standards Authority, who were visiting the Parliament last week, made that very point about how they can police much more what happens in terms of online advertising. You mentioned earlier on in your answer about the speed of people, of the platforms to take things down. Do you think that balance is right, or do you think if that was flagged, that it comes down soon?
Not perfectly placed comment, I will be honest, but I think we know they can do more. Right. When the scrutiny comes down upon them, every time those big corporations step their game up another level, so I think.
Because when you said that, it made me think about a very personal circumstance I had around a video I got sent by a far-right organisation, which was supposed to be a banned video on YouTube, and YouTube had promised to ban it on numerous occasions, but actually it's still available, still reposted, and there's that interaction there. So I think there is something around platforms and how
and
speed
kind
to take
of stuff
things down.
Does have a technological solution, you know. You can reverse search an image now, you can do the same. They have a digital footprint, so actually it should be an automated process now that when those images are posted, they are immediately taken down. I think, you know, there are technological solutions to that kind of thing that they could.
And Ben, you've rightly said numerous times around words being important. How do you strike the balance between freedom of speech and respect on social media? An easy question for you, Ben.
It's Aristotle in the room, you know. it's really, really challenging. And I agree with everything that Victoria's just said around how companies could do more. But we quite rightly live in a society where we encourage and celebrate freedom of speech. I guess the border and the challenge always is, as it is in the criminal law, between when that diverts to hate crime. And we've got an interesting and important discussion coming up here in Scotland as new hate crime legislation is going to be brought forward about how we get that balance right as we go forward. I would say, while encouraging freedom of speech, those of us who have been given the trust of public office have a responsibility to think about how we as representatives conduct ourselves in order to encourage respectful dialogue rather than over amplifications of conflict or division. And I think while I would encourage freedom of speech across the board, particularly all of us, but particularly those of us in public office should always think carefully about using words and arguments respectfully, because that filters down into the tone of the wider political debate. Yeah.
So I'm going to open up for questions just shortly, and I'm going to do some interactive hands up type questions in a moment as well. But I just want the panel to answer one final question from here, and then we'll open up to the floor. We've heard a lot about political trolls around the use of bots on social media, the influence of foreign regimes on domestic political situations, whether that be Russia with the US or Russia with Brexit or anything else. How real is it? How big a problem is it? And just some reflections on what can be done to counteract it from the work you've done before, Paul.
Definitely there's been some attempts by Russia to influence the US elections, but I think that the effect of that has been exaggerated. Right? And it's been exaggerated very much as an attempt by the Clinton campaign to blame other people, to shift blame, when it was evident to everybody that the first entity to blame was the Clinton campaign, which was a complete car crash. Right, I mean, the White House was ahead of the campaign, and they completely managed to lose against what was at the beginning a very weak candidate. Right, so more generally, I think that there is a bit of this tendency, as there is a tendency to blame social media as such, social media with a capital letter, all capitalized, as if social media had its own intentionality. In the same way, there is a tendency to blame bots, to blame hackers, to blame all of that. And for sure, they do have an influence. But any campaign that is intelligent and smart enough can perfectly counteract this influence by creating sufficient levels of support. Right? And indeed, we see bots being used now on social media, especially on Twitter. But the important thing that perhaps I need to say here is that let's remember that Twitter doesn't matter. You can, if you're concerned about your voters and consensus and people, you can perfectly shut down your Twitter account. It doesn't matter at all. Twitter matters for engaging with journalists, with the commentariat, with the public opinion institutions, the producers of public opinion. Politics is done these days on Facebook, exclusively. Like it or not, that's the place where politics happen. Politics in terms of converting people, recruiting people, creating mass mobilization, that's where things happen, right? And actually, bots on Facebook are more difficult.
So right, what you're saying, Paul, is that everyone on Twitter has already made their mind up. There's no undecided voters on Twitter. Normal folk, inverted commas, are on Facebook, and it's the chatting classes that are on Twitter. Is that?
Totally. I mean, Twitter is good for networking, for being in the scene of your own professional political world, for being known, for being invited to things, so that people know you, can find you, right? To publicize your things within the kind of your own tribe, your own kind of professional scene. Right? Politics is about mobilizing the masses, right, and persuading the masses, and thousands and tens of thousands and tens of thousands of people. That's where that is done on Facebook almost exclusively these days.
Yeah. And how big a problem is trolls from young people? So the abuse, the negativity, how much of an impact is the trolls?
I imagine, and I feel like actually, at least in the political sphere, the people who are most affected by the trolls are actually you guys. And it's kind of what's coming into you when you look at the volume of death threats and rape threats and kind of sheer kind of hate abuse that, you know, someone like Diane Abbott can receive in an incredibly short period of time. It's quite shocking. And I think, you know, it's not so much what's happening in between individual people, although obviously this happens, but in the political sphere, it's very much about what's coming up. And in all honesty, I don't know what we can do about that. Yeah. It's you know, it's part of all the things we've been talking about before, about how, you know, the anonymity and the polarization and that reduction down to a few words is really challenging. But I think probably you guys are actually better place to comment on that than we are.
Ben, you wanted to say maybe something slight on trolls and a bit about political, external political interference in domestic political circumstances? Any thoughts?
Well, don't want to tempt fate here, but the amount of abuse that I've received on social media has been quite minimal, to be honest.
Mm. Can we swap accounts, please?
but I do have a block, don't bite philosophy, where, you know, I just will just block people if they're, you know, maybe give them two chances, and then just it is sad, but a lot of the time, absolutely, in what Paolo said, that It's actually on Twitter, in that kind of narrow circle, that you, the trolls linger. Whereas Facebook, well, by no means perfect, gives a much greater capacity for actually a meaningful dialogue, mostly because you've got more words, and you can actually touch on nuance and the intricacies of things more appropriately. And it's harder for people to just hide behind troll accounts, etc. In terms of,
do you think just on that? Do you think social media platforms should ban anonymous accounts?
Well, it's hard to take a view on that because logistically and practically, how would they do it? That's the question, isn't it? Which Victoria touched on. I mean, it's there is technical capacity to do more, and I think it's right that there's continued pressure on the companies to continue to update their mechanisms and their platforms, but to it's an ongoing challenge, isn't it, that we there'll never be a perfect scenario. So I think to try and turn it around, those of us who want to say positive things on social media just need to say them more often and louder and try and change the frame and change the dialogue.
Okay, excellent. So if I'll give to the panel members, and we'll start in reverse order probably this time, is just any response to the final questions and any closing remarks and reflections on the discussion we've had. And if we can limit to about a minute, that'd be great. Ben?
Just to echo what the gentleman just said in his question, let's those of us who want to see social media as a force for positivity and advantageous social change and the development and strengthening of democracy need to use it in that purposeful way with passion and determination. And like all fora of democracy, it'll be what we all contribute into making it be. So I thought you put it perfectly, sir, so more power to your elbow and all of those who want to do the same.
Hear, hear. Victoria?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It can be such a power for good, and I think what I would say, though, is it's not the only thing out there. So use social media, use it in a positive way, but we also mustn't forget to go out and talk to people. And as important as it is that we and politicians and political parties invest in using social media to reach people, we can't stop investing in the places and the community spaces where people meet each other and perhaps meet people who are different to them. And I think it's only through that interaction that we will reduce some of those tensions and discords that sometimes then manifest themselves on social media. But we need to remember that we're humans and talk to each other as well.
Absolutely. Paulo?
Yeah, my point on Facebook was strategical. I mean, in the sense that if you are a digital strategist and you know and you need to decide where you invest the money, if you do it for political purposes, you need to invest it on Facebook. I mean, that's the place where you can actually get new people, new voters, persuade people. And obviously, I'm completely against digital monopolies, and I'm against Facebook being a digital monopoly, and Amazon being a digital monopoly, and Google being a digital monopoly, and these companies paying less than a pop singer in taxes, right? I think that is awful, and that is a long-term issue that we need to face, because either these companies comply with tax regulations, pay their dues to Scotland, to the UK, to Europe, to whatever level, or else something needs to be done, really seriously. I mean, you cannot allow these companies to operate like that because they destroy local companies as well, right? So, I mean, I think that the problem of digital monopolies or oligopolies is the real issue we are facing in the long term, and that we need some very strong solutions from politics.
Thank you to our fantastic panel. Thank you for all the contributions from the room. Can I just emphasise a point that Simon, I think it was, and Ben and Victoria made, is I was struck by the number of hands that went up when I asked about how many people thought division and prejudice was on the rise in our country. And that was a startling. I mean, I feel it and I believe it, but see that reflected in the audience, I think, was quite startling. And the point I'd make is to emphasise what Ben said. We can take personal responsibility. We can take personal responsibility for our own actions and calling out prejudice and hate in all its forms and creating that strong voice and strong community. So don't just like and retweet or share the posts that make you angry or upset you, but actually like, retweet, share and post all the things that make you positive about the world as well and give you some hope. And I think if we as a collective can do that, we've got a chance of challenging the forces of division and hopefully bring back unity as a political principle that is fashionable again. Thank you all so much for your contribution. We must end it there, so I've got to start end by thanking our fantastic panel, to Paolo, Victoria and Ben. Please give them a warm round of applause.